I interviewed Randy Newman once and I asked him why he did it, like why he spent his life writing songs. And he said, it's how I judge myself and how I feel better. And somewhere along the line, you know, that happened to me. It became how I judged myself and how I felt better.
Welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. And that was the voice of John Ronson, who spoke to me in early June from his house in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York. It's hard to know where to start with describing John Ronson's body of work because it's impressive and very varied. He's written several non-fiction journalistic books, which include Them, which was a look at conspiracy theorists, The Men Who Stare at Goats, The Psychopath Test, and So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He's made several documentaries. He's also made two podcast series, The Butterfly Effect and The Last Days of August, both of which looked at the porn industry. He co-wrote the films Frank and the Bong Joon-ha movie Okja, which I've probably just mispronounced. He's got a very distinctive and often funny voice that really comes through all of his work. And if you've read any of John's books or listened to his podcast, you'll know that he gets amazing access, both to people who are in the midst of coping with terrible experiences and trauma and who you would understand if they never wanted to speak to a journalist again, and to groups that are generally wary of outsiders, including the Ku Klux Klan, Islamic fundamentalist groups, and the Church of Scientology. When I got in touch with him, I immediately understood more how he manages to get that access, because he's so warm, empathetic and kind. I found him a really generous and entertaining interviewee, and he shed light on how he researches those big projects, the book he almost wrote about fake blood spatter experts, and why he appears as a character in his own work. Before we start the interview, I'm very happy to say that this episode is sponsored by Arvon, the UK's leading provider of residential creative writing courses. So let me take a minute just to tell you about that. Their writing houses in Devon, Shropshire and Yorkshire will be back as soon as they're able to open. But in the meantime, you can enjoy all the same acclaimed writing tutors, insights and inspiration from your own home. There are readings and masterclasses with authors such as Sebastian Faulks, Deborah Levy and Will Self, as well as whole digital writing weeks on topics like fiction writing and writing for children and young adults. You can also book a one-to-one tutorial with an Arvon tutor of your choosing at your convenience for direct feedback on your work. I'm quite tempted to book in for David Quantick's masterclass, A Short Guide to Writing Everything. David is not only a novelist and a journalist, but also won an Emmy for his work on the TV comedy Veep, so that should be fascinating. To find out more and book in, head over to arvon.org. But now, back to today's interview, and here's John Ronson. Are you working on something at the moment? Are you writing or?
Yeah, I'm working on kind of four things. I try and have like three or four things all happening at once. I've got like a fragment of an idea for a book, and I'm working on a live thing, which I can't tell anything about because I've signed an NDA, and who knows, maybe it'll never happen because of the virus. And I'm finishing off a podcast and a TV drama pilot.
Wow. So why do you like to have three or four things on the go at any one time? That sounds very stressful.
Well, it's partly paranoia, that I never want to have all my eggs in one basket. That's burned me in the past. When I was in my 20s, I presented a late night radio show in Stockport called KFM. I presented with Craig Cash, who went on to do The Royal Family.
Yes. And,
anyway, we were all fine. I enjoyed it so much, just turning up late at night at this radio station and broadcasting into the night. And then we all got fired. The station was taken over and we were fired. And as he fired me, he considerately rubbed my back. and I vowed, and I felt lost. I mean, it was all I wanted in life was to present this show, and I thought, never again am I going to allow one person to have that much control over my life. So that's one of the reasons. There's another more practical reason, which is that if you're working on a project and you hit a wall, I find it's useful, it works, to then move to a different project and then move back to the first one, and you're seeing it with fresh eyes.
Right.
So those are the two main reasons.
Are you in the place where you write?
Yes.
Would you tell me a bit about that?
Okay, well, it's quite bare because we spent all our money buying this place, so we don't have any money left to furnish or decorate it. So it's literally a chair and a desk and a day bed, as a neighbour said to me, for the times I feel overwrought, and a running machine. And that's it. There's a lamp. There's a couple of photos. I wrote the introduction for Chris Stein's second book of photography, Chris Stein from Blondie. Mm-hmm. And in return, he offered me any two of his photographs. So I've got two beautiful framed photographs, one of Debbie Harry holding a copy of The Sun that says, "Women are just slaves." That's the headline. And the other is Basquiat, when he was a very, very young man and unaware, presumably, that he would, one of his paintings is just, I think, sold for more money than any other painting of all time.
Yeah.
And when I look at this photo of Basquiat, he just looks so, so young and sweet and, you know, presumably not knowing what was about to happen in his life.
Yeah.
And then out of the window, I've got two books on my desk, both by Craig Brown. One is his biography of the Beatles, and one is a book called One on One. And out of my window, I can see there's a road. We live in the village, and then there's a pond on the other side of the road. But unfortunately, I mean, the pond is beautiful to look at, but constantly there's snapping turtles trying to cross the road to lay eggs in our garden, and they get run over. So I'm spending...
It's a bloodbath out there.
I'm spending half of my life literally leaping from my desk, running into the road.
Oh, God.
To stop cars from hitting snapping turtles.
That's so stressful.
Yeah, and then sometimes we have to wheelbarrow them to safety. It's a full-time job. But it's been terribly stressful, the whole turtle incident.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Do you lie down on the day bed when you get back?
Well, one time I got really upset because I failed to stop one from dying. And I basically laid down for the rest of the day.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That is really upsetting.
I know, it is. Oh. It is. I mean, it's funny because it's turtles, but it's not funny because it's life or death. And it's really anxiety inducing.
Oh, dear. So you've got this very varied CV. And I was wondering if you think of yourself primarily as a journalist or something else. I mean, you said you're working on a drama at the moment, and obviously you've made films in the past, and you've done the, you've got podcasts and documentaries and books, and so what do you think of yourself as?
I guess a writer, and most of the time it's journalism, but then once in a while I kind of veer into fiction. A writer. If I was going to sound more pompous, I suppose I'd say storyteller, because that is different from being a writer, because it's, especially in nonfiction, not many nonfiction writers are storytellers, I find, and I don't quite understand why people don't do that more often.
Yeah. I remember being struck by, when I was reading your books, that there's a very tangible storytelling element to them, and that you also are a sort of character
within your nonfiction books.
Yes.
It's quite an unusual approach.
Yeah, that started because I just noticed that was the easiest way for me to write a story, was to do it through the prism of my own experience. And then after a while, I tired of it and tried to write in different ways where I wasn't a character. And editors always told me to put myself back in there.
Yeah.
So now I'm at peace with that.
I remember there was a very funny bit in the psychopath test where you, I suppose some people maybe would call this a sort of faux naive narrator.
Usually, something. I should interrupt and say, usually when I'm accused of faux naivety, what people don't realise is how genuinely naive I am.
But you talk about how A.A. Gill was once very rude, or maybe more than once very rude about you in a TV review, and then you start sort of speculating about whether perhaps he might have been a psychopath, and it's very funny. And but it also sort of illustrates the point, the larger point that you're making in the book, that these kind of tests can make people go a bit mad with their own power to define a psychopath. Do you think that sort of narrator's voice that you've honed helps you find a way in for the reader?
Yeah, I do, especially if it's stories about, you know, extremism or kind of stray, you know, I'm a sort of, you know, I'm the reader, right, going into you know, with all of my anxieties and my own issues and biases. I represent the reader, I think, in those situations.
Yeah, and that...
I'm being aware, I think a lot of nonfiction writers shy away from writing about their own biases. But I think, and they want to present themselves as these... you know, figures of authority.
Yeah.
But I always think it's so much more fun, and also more fun to read, and just more true if the narrator doesn't present themselves as this sort of perfect being.
Well, also, perhaps increasingly at the moment, quite important to expose your own biases or the perspective that you're coming at something from. And, you know, rather than presenting yourself as perhaps as journalists traditionally would, as being objective.
Yeah, it always sort of bugs me a little bit when I see a journalist doing that. The memory that I always, that always pops in my head was this, I'm not going to name him because I'm being like mean to him, but there was this Irish presenter who was a little bit like me. At one time, he infiltrated the fashion industry, and he had hidden cameras all over his body. And somebody gave him some cocaine, and he went into the toilet and made a big show of opening up this little packet of cocaine and putting it down the toilet with this sort of, you know, look of
disgust.
Disgust, yeah. And I was sitting there thinking, You work for the BBC. Like, don't tell me you've never seen cocaine before. So I also thought, no, that kind of piety and superiority. What I don't like about it is that it's not egalitarian, and I'm a believer in egalitarianism.
Yeah.
It's kind of hierarchical. I'm always suspicious of people like me who go into situations and the purpose is to present themselves as a representative of righteous society, whereas the other people are somehow lower in the hierarchy.
And you've got something to teach them.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, sometimes that's the case, but it's just not a pleasant... I just don't think it's what should be motivating a writer in that situation.
Yeah. Where did being a writer start for you?
When I was 18 and I went to London and went to college, I started writing for the college magazine. And we had this really glamorous teacher called David Cardiff, who was married to Lynn Barber.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she, you know, is one of the greatest journalists of my generation. You know, I think one of the most inspiring writers, certainly when I was that age. And David Cardiff took me to a cafe on Riding House Street in central London and said to me, "You're the only person who writes for the college magazine who's actually a good writer."
Well, that's nice.
Yeah, and it was the first, but I don't want to sound like Oliver Twist, but it was the first kind of tangible compliment I remember really having. And I thought, okay, I'll be a writer. And I didn't really want to be a writer because it seemed so solitary. And back then, the solitary life didn't seem appealing. And then a couple of years later, I started playing keyboards in the Frank Sidebottom band up in Manchester. And the manager said the same thing to me. He said, "You're not cut out for being in the music business. You're going to end up being some kind of writer." So people kept telling me that I should be a writer. So eventually I sort of gave into it.
Yeah. By the way, this afternoon I watched Frank.
Oh, did you like it?
I really liked it. I really liked it. I thought it was so funny. And I could so hear your voice in it.
Yeah,
I thought it was great.
Oh, thank you. I really like Frank. It took us like 7 years to write that film. Although admittedly quite a lot of that 7 years was me waiting for, I would like write 30 pages, send it to my co-writer Peter Strawn, and then wait 9 months for him to make his changes and then send it back to me, and then I'd like immediately. So quite a lot of the 7 years just waiting for Peter. Peter was so in demand. I mean, he was writing Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which he ended up getting nominated for an Oscar for. So I don't blame him. But it was a great experience. I mean, learning how to write screenplays from Peter was really valuable.
Yeah. As a sort of features writer, which is what I am most of the time, you know, somebody who turns around an article in probably no more than 2 days generally, when people talk about projects that they've spent 7 years writing, I just cannot fathom having the patience to work on one project for that period of time.
And similarly, I can't fathom how anybody can write something in 2 days. And I say that with total respect. Like, when I look at columnists, I mean, Marina Hyde, I mean,
oh,
Jesus.
She's amazing.
Yeah, but my brain just doesn't work that way. I'm very slow. And in fact, when I did write weekly columns, I just hated it. Like the stress of it was unbearable. You know, I need months to write.
Yeah,
I can't do it. I'm in awe of people at Marina Hyde.
So going back a bit, so you had this encouragement at university, and then where did you go from there?
Well, I quit college after 2 years of doing, I was doing journalism at college. After 2 years, I became the social secretary of the student union. So I was in charge of the bar and the concert hall, putting on shows. And In the midst of that, I met a band called Man from Del Monte, and I met Frank Sidebottom, and they both at once basically asked me if I'd want to move to Manchester to work with them as the manager of the Man from Del Monte and as Frank Sidebottom's agent and keyboard player. So I did. I quit college and moved to Manchester and started doing that. So I ended up touring with Frank Sidebottom and with the Man from Del Monte for probably 5, 6, 7 years. I did a tiny bit of writing for City Life, which was the Manchester's version of Time Out. But that was basically to get free sandwiches at the every a couple of times a week there was a film screening at the Corner House, which was the art cinema in Manchester. So I became City Life's film reviewer, really for the free sandwiches that they would give us after the movie. There was something quite nice about, you know, if you've got nothing, you've got nothing to lose, as I believe Bob Dylan once said.
But at what point did you hit a level of success with your writing? Like, was there a breakthrough moment?
Yes, there was. There was this new magazine called The Sunday Correspondent, and I bought the very first issue. And I remember this. This was really a Damascus moment for me. I came back from the shop and I was reading the magazine as I was walking back from the shop. This was on Dickinson Road in Rusholme in Manchester. And I saw this article, and it was written by a writer named Luke Jennings. And it was an article about a official Andrew Lloyd Webber lookalike and how hard it was for him to find work. And then the following week, there was a follow-up article from a friend of his who was complaining that this official Andrew Lloyd Webber lookalike was becoming so egotistical, he was starting to think he actually was Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I just thought, I thought this was so funny, the way it was written and just the sort of comic absurdity. It reminded me of Kurt Vonnegut. And so I wrote to the Sunday Correspondent and sent them a couple of my, probably stuff I'd written in the college magazine and City Life. And they wrote back and offered me work. And so I started writing features for the Sunday Correspondent.
Yeah.
The very first one was about a neurotic comedian. And I just spent a day with him, really just documenting his anxieties.
Oh God, sounds brilliant.
Yeah. It was, I had found my place.
I found a piece you'd written earlier, which you said in it that when you were 20, you sent a screenplay to the BBC and they said, I don't know how much of this was exaggerated for comic effect, but you said that they sent you a rejection letter basically saying, normally we would tell you to keep trying, but don't bother.
It was not a comic exaggeration. That is literally what they said. I wrote this bizarre. I had no idea what I was doing. This is when I lived in Rusholme. It was between touring with the Man from Del Monte. I wrote this radio play, and yeah, that was their reply. It was like, we can't offer you encouragement. You have no idea what you're doing.
Oh God! I mean, I think that you must have a sort of steely inner confidence and determination, because apart from that, which sounds brutal, but also when you look at the projects that you've done, you've taken on so many things that most people would be intimidated by, like being with extremists, being with, you know, going to Broadmoor to interview people.
Although that was just exciting. I mean, who wouldn't take the opportunity of visiting Broadmoor?
Well, I suppose that's right. I mean, I think I'd be a bit nervous about it.
I was definitely a little nervous, but that was such an adventure.
Where did this sort of determination and courage come from?
Courage, you know, when you said that, I remembered something that Louis Theroux was asked a similar question, like, and his reply was, not doing it feels worse. And I think that's a good answer. A story not told or an adventure not had, you know, feels worse than doing something frightening and stressful and tiring.
Yeah.
Because I had like a bad time growing up in Cardiff, you know, I wasn't popular and, you know, I was sort of, you know, bullied quite a lot. Maybe I felt this kind of desperate need to succeed, to kind of heal the wounds of my earlier years.
That's something to prove.
I didn't want to prove to
not to other people,
no. But maybe I understood, I just wanted a sort of solid place in the world. And then I realised that for whatever reason, I knew how to do it. Like, I knew how to write. And somewhere along the line, I interviewed Randy Newman once and I asked him why he did it, like why he spent his life writing songs. And he said, it's how I judge myself and how I feel better.
Mm.
And somewhere along the line, you know, that happened to me. It became how I judged myself and how I felt better.
Yeah. So when you're working on a book, say something like, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, they're incredibly research heavy, your books, and there's a lot of you out in the world meeting people and going to places. How do you approach it? Do you do any writing at the beginning, or is it months and months of research and notes and recordings, and then ultimately you're sitting down and writing?
Well, that second version is definitely the better and more sensible version, which I didn't do with So You've Been Publicly Shamed. I'd consequently spent months writing things that I ended up abandoning because I hadn't figured the book out when I started writing. So that was a mistake. That book started with, do you know Clive Stafford Smith, the human rights lawyer?
No.
Oh, he's amazing. He was a death row lawyer in Louisiana for years, and he created the charity Reprieve, and now he's a Guantanamo lawyer. He's really a heroic, amazing man. Anyway, shortly after the psychopath test came out, we ended up doing a TEDx event together in Marrakesh. I get quite a lot of TEDx offers, and I always turn them down unless they're in really glamorous places. So the two I said yes to were Marrakesh and Martha's Vineyard. And Clive was in Marrakesh, and we became friends. And he was really encouraging me to basically write a Men Who Stare at Goats about court experts. His big thing, well, he's got lots of big things, but one of his big things is court experts are all pseudoscientists who can't be trusted. It's all nonsense. Blood spatter, hair analysis, it's all nonsense.
Oh God, how dispiriting.
Yeah, I know. And Clive's a polemicist, so I think there's an element of truth to what he was saying, but it's not the full story. But Clive was like, this is what you have to do, John. I don't think I've ever told this story before. Clive said, this is what you have to do. And he told me this over several lunches and dinners. It was kind of like a brain one. I'm not kidding. I adore Clive. But he said, what you need to do is create a fake court science. Just invent something out of nowhere and then set yourself up as a court expert and see how far you'll get. Like, you'll be invited to give evidence at trials. And I was like, Clive, like, at what point does this veer into contempt of court? and Clive was like, we'll worry about that later. But I also remember Clive saying to me, you've got a real problem if you want to write about courtrooms because people aren't interested. And that seemed unlikely to me because we love watching courtroom dramas and stuff. But actually, I think, to a large extent, Clive was right that for some reason, people don't want to read about prisons, prisoners, courts. But anyway, I started going, I did start going to courtroom expert classes every Wednesday evening. I'd learn.
What's a courtroom expert class?
It was near the Barbican. I remember that, and it was just somebody teaching people how to be court experts. This is so many years ago. This is like 2013, and I can't remember the details. But there was lots of stuff about blood spatter and fingerprints, and it was like a sort of general course in learning about the court sciences. And I went to several of them, and I was kind of flailing around a little bit. Like, I really didn't want to do what Clive had suggested because it really felt sketchy.
Illegal, yeah.
Yeah, it really felt illegal. So I was flailing around. And then in the middle of this, I moved to New York, and I also started noticing that there was a different sort of justice happening, which was social media justice. So I noticed sort of Twitter justice at its very inception.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, okay, this is maybe the solution to the problem that Clive had posed, which was people aren't interested in reading about justice. I thought maybe people will be interested in reading about justice if it's social media justice, because that's kind of new and interesting. It's something that we're all part of. Mm-hmm. So really, that was how I started writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And so all the stuff I'd written about blood spatter and about going to this course and all of this, it just all just became useless. And I'd spent months.
But I think that illustrates the value of your patience, because you kept going with it, even though you weren't quite sure what you were going to do with it, until it became clear what you could do. So
yes, it's really rare that things arrive fully formed. It's happened to me maybe once or twice in my life, but it's really rare.
Yeah.
Most of the time, it's exactly what you just described. It's just chipping, 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 and patience. And I remember Roald Dahl's got a really good list of writing rules somewhere online. And one of them was, no one's telling you what to do. You've got, you have to be self-generating.
Yeah. Have you ever had to chuck projects out, having invested lots of time in them?
Oh God, so often. I've got folders as long as your arm of abandoned ideas. It's very dispiriting.
Yeah.
The main one, which I spent 6 months on, was, again, I was going to write to many scapegoats of the credit card industry, and I abandoned that because it was just too hard to make a kind of sing on the page.
Yeah.
Yeah. But unfortunately, my timing, had I continued with it, would have been perfect, because this was a few years before the credit crunch.
Right.
And there is a world where I'd have bought out a book about the sort of dodginess of the credit industry just as
everyone got interested in it.
Yeah.
I mean, you have had pretty good timing, because then was timed quite well around... It's weird to say that something was timed well around September the 11th, because obviously that was a terrible, terrible thing, but that you'd writing about extremism just at the point at which suddenly everybody started talking about
extremism. And not just extremism in that book, but also the rise of conspiratorial thought.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Which again, sort of burst into the mainstream just as them came out. And maybe partly because of them.
Yeah.
Maybe people became interested in conspiracy theorists and conspiracy theories in part because of them. And yet the same thing happened with the psychopath test. The timing was really good. That book came out just as people started thinking both about psychopaths and their power in the corporate world, but also the opposite argument, which is maybe we overdiagnose, maybe labelling people with mental health disorders has its issues. Those things became, I mean, obviously people were thinking about that stuff in the 60s with like R.D. Lang and Thomas Sasse and people like that, but I think my book came out just as people started thinking about it again in around 2011, 2012.
Yeah. And then So You've Been Publicly Shamed as well, I think, was, I mean, I was reading an interview that you did 5 years ago about it, and it sort of felt like something I could be reading now in terms of all the issues that were going on with Twitter then are, if anything, just amplified 5 years later.
Yeah, again, my timing was good. I remember feeling really frustrated with myself and thinking, if I'd worked a little bit harder on So You've Been Publicly Shamed, a little bit faster, then the book could have come out 6 months earlier and it would have been even more prescient. And I remember saying that to Adam Curtis, my friend, the documentary maker, and he basically said, no, that would have been bad. Like, you can actually bring something out too early and you're just ridiculed for it.
You miss the moment.
And you miss the moment. You miss the moment, not from being too late, but from being too early. But with So Shamed, So You've Been Publicly Shamed kind of came out just the right time.
Yeah. When you look across your body of work, do you see any sort of common, is there a thread through it? Could you identify what you're interested in as a writer?
I think trying to demonize demons is a big part of it, which I suppose is another way of saying trying to be egalitarian, you know, trying to give everybody equal. I was going to say respect, and that's true unless they're people who behave malevolently and hurt other people. But I think everybody else deserve curiosity.
Yeah.
But I try and be as empathetic and curious and compassionate as possible, and I guess shine a light into the darkness. And where I can, that comes with empathy for people who usually aren't empathised with, like people in the porn industry or people who were publicly shamed online for having not done very much wrong at all.
Yeah.
But then on other occasions, it's with people who don't deserve empathy because they're Nazis or, you know, they hurt other people. But I still try and fill them in as human beings.
Yeah. How do you navigate the moment when some of the people that you've written about read what you've written? I mean, there presumably must be occasions where people are not thrilled with the outcome.
Yes. I mean, it causes me a lot of anxiety. You have to, I suppose you think about who you're writing it for. Are you writing it for the person being written about? Are you writing it for your readers? Are you writing it for society? And I suppose you have to sort of balance those three things. And in each instance, you think, well, which is the more appropriate?
Yeah.
I guess that's the answer. You know, journalism, whenever you write about real people, there is always that danger. And I'm incredibly happy when I write something that the people in the book like. But when it doesn't happen, I guess if I feel I've been fair, then I feel upset that they're upset. But
as long as I've been, it.
Yeah, because if I've been ethical and fair, then you sort of think, well, you know, I did what I could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking that going back to say you've been publicly shamed, the sort of legacy of that, as far as I can tell as an outsider, seems to be that you get bombarded with tweets every time somebody does something and is, you know, leapt on social media.
Yeah.
And you seem to be sort of seen as a bit of a judge of what is appropriate shaming and what is unreasonable shaming. What has that been like?
Well, I don't enjoy it because it's, you know, there's so many reasons why I don't enjoy it. Part of the reason is I think the book was politicized by both sides in ways that weren't entirely fair. So the free speech kind of absolutists liked the book because I was defending people who'd been like torn apart by woke people at times. But I'm not one of those people. I'm not a free speech absolutist. I'm left wing. I'm a liberal.
Yeah.
I believe to a large extent in political correctness, for want of a better phrase. So I don't like the book being used in that way. And then on the other side, the book is sort of attacked for defending the indefensible. But I don't do that in the book. I don't defend the indefensible. I defend the defensible. So when people say, oh, I can't wait to hear what... I mean, the classic example was the Amy Cooper, Chris Cooper situation quite recently. The Central Park.
This is the guy who was bird watching and told a woman off for having her dog off its lead.
Yes. And then she called the police and was like, I'm being hassled by an African. I mean, it was an African American. It was horrific.
Yeah.
And I woke up the next morning to like 50 tweets, looking forward to hearing what John Robson has to say about this. And quite a lot of the tweets were genuinely curious, like they weren't getting at me. They weren't sort of saying, oh, can't wait to hear what John Ronson has to say about this. You know, quite a lot of them were like genuinely curious. But she it was awful what she
yeah,
did.
It was terrible, malicious. It's not the same as the lady who tweeted the AIDS joke. Yeah.
Which was a joke mocking her own privilege in the sort of tradition of people like Randy Newman.
Yeah.
It was a bad version of an honourable liberal joke. Whereas what this woman did was appalling.
Yeah.
So I saw, you know, so then I sort of disappointed some free speech people by saying it's completely different.
Yeah.
But then I felt a little bad too, because, you know, she was then being, you know, hounded and hounded and hounded. And Chris Cooper, the bird watcher, had to sort of say, leave her alone. And then I thought, well, you know, in my zeal to differentiate what she had done from the people in the book, did I then, you know, sort of ignore her disproportionate punishment? It's a bit of a minefield.
Yeah, I think the problem is that your book is very nuanced, and as we all know, Twitter is not the home of nuance.
My God, it's not. Also, there's other reasons why I don't love being Mr. Shame, and one of them is that I don't want to be pigeonholed. For me, storytelling is about trying to solve mysteries, and you can't solve mysteries if you're pigeonholed in one particular area, because you already understand the area. I try to go into new worlds that I don't understand, so that's another reason. Also, I kind of became a little bit of a meme for a while with that book, you know, as like Mr. Shame, and there's something slightly dehumanizing about being a meme, because if you're a meme, you're other people's plaything, and those people probably haven't even read the book, so they're sort of drawing second or third hand ideas about the book.
Yeah.
So for all of those reasons, it just made me feel pretty kind of uncomfortable. I felt like, you know, my book was slightly weaponized in a way that wasn't, you know, fair.
Yeah, you're a slight victim of its success.
I mean, this is a small complaint, like, because 95% of the people who read the book, you know, really liked it. And I write books for people who understand, you know, nuance and humour and storytelling. Yes. So my book's for them. It's not for outsiders who want to use my book in a way that it's not intended.
Yeah.
I realise I sound like I was complaining there, but I mean, I'm basically really happy with Shamed. It was just that one slither of the way that it was used that I wasn't happy with.
Yeah, no, completely understandably. What have you, can you think of anything specific that you've learnt over your career that has improved your writing?
Empathy. The older you get, the more damage you accumulate. Bad things happen in your life, you know, tragedies, whatever, mental health stuff. And so you start to realise that other people who may have seemed, you know, eccentric or clownish, just are really just products of their own struggles. And so the more you struggle, the more you can empathise with other people who struggle.
So that's a sort of product of life, having just been here for longer.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything in terms of
the actual writing?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much my writing has really changed over the 30-odd years I've been doing it. It's always been about, you know, what I learned from people like Kurt Vonnegut and Raymond Carver is to try and take as complicated an idea as possible and reduce it to something simple and fun to read.
Yeah.
And I think I've improved to an extent, but not, I haven't improved that much. It's like once I realised that that was the way I wanted to write, to take something really complicated and just take out as many words as possible until the complicated idea is expressed in the fewest possible words. And when you take out all the other words, what you're left is, you know, allowing the reader to read between the lines. It becomes like a sort of partnership between the reader and the writer if you're not over-explaining things.
Mm.
And I think I've always done that. I did it in Them, and I did it in So You've Been Publicly Shamed, so I think I've always done that. So I think my style of writing hasn't really changed too much.
It just came out fully formed.
Yeah, someone DM'd me the other day complimenting me on a line in Them, which is now, that book came out in like 2000, or even a little, I was writing it in 98, 99, and he reminded me of a line in Them and wanted to compliment me on it, and it was how extremists think of people like me, you know, liberal Jews, as having this sort of fanatical, depraved belief system. And I wrote, I like it when they say that because it makes me feel like, it makes me feel as if I have a belief system. And that's a good example of taking a complicated idea and reducing it to its fewest number of words. And I was doing that in the 90s.
Yeah. But in terms of, as a storyteller, I mean, there's also a huge amount of structure that has to go into your books because you are leading the reader through your own sort of... I'm going to say journey of discovery. That's a terrible, terrible phrase, but you understand what I mean.
It's funny. This morning I got an email from somebody. I'm doing a talk and she said, do you want to call it your journey? And I emailed back saying, well, the word journey is a bit highfalutin, but can we think of around the word journey?
Well, that's the one that sprung to mind at the moment. But did that take practice?
The problem with me is that every time I write a book, and it works, I learn nothing. When I start a new book, I'm totally back at square one as a novice writer who's never written anything.
Really?
Every time, yeah. It's really unfortunate. I think it's because every book I write is like a culmination of everything I've learned up to that point in life.
Yeah.
So each new book is starting from scratch. And that includes learning how to write from scratch again.
Yeah.
I wish it wasn't so. And it might sound like I'm just trying to be modest, but it's really true.
Well, they come out very well if you're doing them from scratch every time.
I really am. That's probably the reason why it takes me so many years to write each book.
And what are you proudest of as a writer?
I'm really proud of the trajectory of the psychopath test, the way each chapter takes you to the next one.
Mm.
It was really lucky. All my books are hard to write, but the psychopath test was probably the easiest. I just had a lot of luck. For instance, I wanted to write about psychopaths, and then I thought, okay, I'll take a little tangent and write about anti-psychiatrists. And that took me to the Scientologists, who told me, because they're anti-psychiatrists, and they told me about this guy in Broadmoor who faked madness to get out of a prison sentence, and now he was stuck in Broadmoor and nobody would believe he was sane. And did I want to go to Broadmoor to meet this guy? So I was like, yeah. And and then it turned out that the reason why he faked madness, according to Broadmoor, was because he was a psychopath. So what an incredible, like, how fortunate was that? And that kept happening with the psychopath test. So that trajectory of how one adventure just leads very naturally to another, I'm really proud of that.
That was John Ronson, and if you head to his Twitter account quickly, tickets may still be on sale for a video event he's doing on the 9th of August on how to write first-person narrative long-form non-fiction. If you missed that, I find it very difficult to pick a favourite book of John's, so just maybe buy all of them, or any of them. And for something quite thought-provoking, I'd really recommend his most recent podcast series, The Last Days of August, which looks at the life and death of the porn actress August Ames. Today's episode was brought to you by Arvon, the UK's leading provider of residential creative writing courses. Book in for their new digital programme, Arvon at Home, which brings their acclaimed roster of creative writing tutors into the comfort of your home for readings, masterclasses, one-to-ones and writing weeks. Find out more at arvon.org. This is the last episode of this series of In Writing, so I'm going to take a little break. But until I'm back, there are now 20 interviews out there for you to go back and listen to, including poets, novelists, screenwriters, journalists and more. Please do stay in touch with me on Twitter, where my handle is @HattieHattie. And thank you so much for listening.